You're listening to WBH Radio. I'm your host, William Holly. This is episode 57. As always, I appreciate you guys checking in. In my hand, I have a book titled The Cap, How Larry Fleischer and David Stern Built the Modern NBA. And joining me via remote is the gentleman who authored this book, labor lawyer, adjunct law professor here in Brooklyn, Mr. Joshua Mendelson. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you stopping in. First and foremost, congratulations on having your first book published. This is a big deal.
Thank you. It is a big deal. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You should be very proud. When did this book come out?
Came out in October.
October 2020. What's the reception been like? What type of feedback have you received?
I mean, honestly, really good. I mean, when you write something and you've never written anything in your life, you really have no idea what to expect. Right. And so far, the response has been really, really great. It's gotten really nice reviews. It's gotten, I've gotten really nice feedback. You know, I've had conversations with people that I never would have thought, you kind of just do something you don't really expect people to be interested in it. And, it's had gotten nice response from all over the world, people in Brazil and Portugal, Turkey, like people all over the world are reading it, which is like, what an incredible thing to have happen that you just don't really expect.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it thoroughly, man. When you talk about business and basketball, like this is it. I was telling you offline that I had Bob Ryan on the podcast, and I brought the book up to him because you had referenced his articles a few times in the book. And he said, yeah, he read it. He read it. So you are on the right path, Joshua. When did you start this project?
Probably about 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
I had kind of I've always liked the business of the NBA, and I tried to kind of just find like a history, and there wasn't one. And there's a lot about baseball, there's some about football, and there just wasn't really kind of this type of book, about the labor history, the economic history, how these things develop, the characters who are kind of building the business that we love. And so I just kind of started looking into it, and then I just kept doing it. And then at a certain point, my now wife, my then girlfriend, was like, all right, you can't, you got to do something. You can't just have like a file on your computer that makes you feel good. You got to try and get it out there. So that's right. Basically what happened.
So your mission was to set out and just kind of piece together the history of the league.
Yeah, that's part of it.
The business history.
The business history. And, I also, look, I'm a labor lawyer. This is what I do, and I think that it's really interesting. And I think that a lot of times these things get misconstrued, or there's a belief that, there's a belief that these institutions that exist in sports, came down from God and were always going to be this way. And no matter what happens, there was always going to be a salary cap, or there was always going to be this, or this is the right thing. And that's not really true. It's people in a room trying to work something out, and maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong. Maybe they have a vision of something, maybe they don't. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of also wanted to demystify some of the, what has will always be type view that I think is pervasive in sports, that I don't think is
accurate.
I think it's an assumption that is not necessarily accurate.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, Josh, let's get right into it. As a sports fan, I always sat back and I looked at the landscape and I saw individuals in Major League Baseball like Alex Rodriguez making unlimited amounts of money. And I wondered, why do NBA players, the great Kobe Bryant, the great LeBron James, why is there a limit to the amount of money they can make? So Larry Fleischer represented the players. He was the lead lawyer for the Players Association. Why on earth would him and the players agree to having a limit to their salaries? Why would they agree to having a cap on the money they can earn?
So, William, that's a fantastic question. And that was the question that I started with. Because I had always operated under the assumption that the only reason why anyone would have agreed to any circumstance like this is that it was shoved down the players' throats. They hated it. There was nothing they got out of it. They were weak. They had bad representation. And that was honestly, and before I did this research, that was kind of what I thought. And I don't think, you know, and the difference, there's been tremendous evolution over time. And so the book that I wrote and the history that I'm writing about is different than what's going on now or what's gone on in between. And so the framework that they agreed to in 82, 83 is different than now. I would think it's much less player friendly than it was at the time. And I think that you have to look at these circumstances not as a monolith that what they agreed to in 82, 83 was always going to be that way and it wouldn't change. It has changed dramatically. What they did, right, and then, and that was kind of a preamble as to what's now, but then what the NBA was very different than it is now, right? It was not as successful economically, right? You had, they were clearly the third sport behind baseball, behind football. They were not as prevalent on television. You know, I wrote about it a bit in the book. You know, CBS wasn't showing the finals live. They had by far the lowest television contract, all of those types of things. You also had a series of poor management and poor ownership, you know, that kind of spent poorly. And then you also had real competition in the form of the ABA that was ratcheting up salaries. And once again, I'm not defending or saying a salary cap is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not saying, you know, I don't think there is any need for it now. There is one now, and there may not have been a need for one then. What I wrote was the history as to what occurred. But basically what the NBA players saw in the early 1980s, right? And the other aspect is that the NBA owners, for the first time in the history of sports, opened the books, right? There's a quote in the book from David Stern, which says, there was no reason to fight about what the truth was.
Right.
They really believed, and they really were, and the NBA was losing money. And they had a series of weak franchises. So Larry Fleischer was the head of the union, said no. He's like, I'm not doing any of this. You guys need, this is your problem. This is not my problem. You have to have better owners who market better, who invest in their teams. This is your problem of bad management. This is not my problem. And there's a very clear logic to doing that. And he was right in saying so. At a certain point, what the NBA came back with was some version of, hey, would you agree to some general limitation on team salary in exchange for a guaranteed percentage of revenues, right? And an obligation that every team would need to spend some percentage of that, right? Because what you had was you had the Lakers who were spending money. You had the Knicks who were spending money. But you had a lot of teams that weren't spending any money at all. The Indiana Pacers, the Utah Jazz, the Denver Nuggets. And then you had teams like Donald Sterling's San Diego Clippers. You had Ted Stepien's Cleveland Cavaliers, who were either spending poorly or who were deferring money far into the future that were creating some version of instability. And so what the NBA players, the reason why they agreed to it, what they agreed to, and we can go through the details of how they did it, and there's all kinds of machinations, was they made a bet that was, one, we have unstable ownership groups that we want to stabilize through some version of revenue sharing. Two, we're willing to agree if we get a percentage of revenue comparable to where we were, which was 53%. Three, we want to make sure that these teams will have to spend. We don't want to have a circumstance like, you know, the Pittsburgh Pirates who spend $34 million when the Dodgers are spending $250 million right now. They want to make sure that every team would have to spend. And four, they wanted some aspect, right, of exceptions to the salary cap. Right? We'll agree to some team limitation, but we want to make sure that if you have the best player in the league, he can sign for whatever he wants. There was no max salary in 82, 83. So they could sign Larry Bird to whatever they wanted, right? We want to make sure that if you have a player who's retiring, right? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is retiring from the NBA. We want to make sure that you can replace him with real money. You know, they wanted to make sure that there would be mechanisms in place to spur spending. But they wanted to make sure they had a guaranteed percentage of revenues. They wanted to make sure they had a guaranteed percentage of television revenue specifically. And that was the framework of the deal that they did. Some of that has been proven to be wise. Some of that has been chipped away. Mm-hmm. And the other thing just to keep in mind, I know I'm giving you a long-winded answer, but your question is the right one, which is why on earth would the players ever agree to this? Right. And there's a logic that they shouldn't have, mm-hmm. right? You know, I'm not saying that necessarily what they did was right or wrong. You know, there's logic that it isn't. It is a system that was created. I am not saying whether it's good or bad. I'm saying that it simply was. But the one other thing that I'll add is that Larry Fleischer was a CPA and an accountant, and he was also an agent. Yeah. And so he had spent his entire career identifying loopholes, identifying things in these agreements, expanding them to the benefit of players. And he continued to do that after the system existed. I didn't go into it tremendously in the book, but that was kind of the framework. It's kind of a long-winded answer to your question. But
Joshua, one of the things that stood out about your book, and you mentioned it earlier, when I learned that the league had a cap, I assumed it was because the players were weak. But reading your book, that wasn't the case. Larry Fleischer and the players were wielding some power. You mentioned it. The NBA owners would say, hey, we're losing money. Larry Fleischer and the players said, well, let me see your books. So in a sense, Larry Fleischer kind of did the league a solid. If you could speak to the power or the standing of Larry Fleischer and the players' union at that point. And before you answer, I'll give a quote here. This was Jerry Buss, who was the owner of the Lakers at the time. He said of Fleischer, you know, Fleischer decided to make a contract. He visualized correctly. He was saving basketball.
So, and William, I appreciate you bringing this up because I feel like a lot of the conversations I've had are about the economics. A lot of what I wrote about in the book, or what I tried to write about in the book, was the development of the NBPA and how they grew and how they gained power. And part of that was Larry Fleischer, yes. Right? Larry Fleischer was a brilliant guy, a creative guy, but he did a phenomenal job, to the players' credit and to his credit, of developing phenomenal, impressive, incredible player leadership, right? From Tommy Heinsohn, but then to Oscar Robertson, to Paul Silas, to Bob Lanier, right? Mm-hmm. And then beyond those guys, to guys like Bill Russell, to Elgin Baylor, right? To Bob Bill Bradley, to Willis Reed.
Junior Bridgman,
right? Mm-hmm. Top to bottom, incredibly impressive, strong leadership at the highest levels of players. Mm-hmm. And at you know, I mean, I will tell you, these were really impressive, courageous guys. You know, the fact that, you know, I wrote about in the book, right? In 1970, the NBA players sued the NBA. They said the NBA is an unlawful monopoly. We think you are in violation of the law and we are going to do it. And when did they do it? They did it during the middle of the Eastern Conference Finals. The Knicks are in the finals and Larry Fleischer is flanked by Bill Bradley, Willis Reed, Oscar Robertson, and Kevin Lockery, right? Mm-hmm. That is who is now. If that doesn't send a message to ownership that I have the top players in the league behind me. Mm-hmm. They are with me. I don't know what does. I don't know what can. And so he built an incredible union that had tremendous leadership, right? This wasn't a circumstance in which, hey, they're not really paying attention. The players aren't really involved. Mm-hmm. You know, the union is kind of an afterthought. Yeah. Like, no, this is the top guys in the league taking an interest in their union, taking a leadership in their union, and being you know, led by Larry Fleischer, who was, you know, who was a tremendous visionary,
yes,
right? Who saw the success of the league, and so, you know, and so this wasn't a circumstance. I agree with you. I had the same thought. Look, I'm conflicted. I'm conflicted about the idea of any limitation on a player's ability to earn the maximum amount they can. I am conflicted by that because I don't see a reason why that should be. I understand the logic of what Fleischer did, and I think the players bought into it, and I think it's a reasonable, and in some ways, there was wisdom in it. But Larry Fleischer spent 20 years building a union of tremendous leadership from all levels of the players. He had tremendous buy-in. I mean, you know, even, you know, I wrote about it a bit in the book. When they were negotiating this, there was a strike date that was set to happen to coincide with the playoffs, right? And by the time that occurs, you know, and I wrote about it in the book, you have Kareem coming out in favor. If you have Larry Bird coming out in favor. Larry Bird, who had a lot to lose, comes out and says, well, the league goes under, it goes under, right? He had the buy-in of the player leadership, not the stars, but also the broader membership. And so I think that cannot be discounted in terms of evaluating, you know, what players did and how they did it. There was a concession in terms of agreeing to any cap. I think that their view was, one, we're guaranteed a percentage of revenues. Two, we're going to see how this works, because they thought that they still were being overseen by a court. And three, I think that there was real worry that some teams would fold. You know, I don't know how real it was. You know, I think that they had real concern over it. You know, part of the deal was they guaranteed that the jobs would exist. I think that it is a unique deal that I don't think someone who wasn't in Fleischer's position could agree to, right? I think that somebody who's starting out, right? I think that there's a degree to which, you know, and I think that you said Bob Ryan said either side could have been on the other side. And I think that that's true. I think that it's a circumstance which you have two negotiators on either side who are able to, who are in a unique position to have credibility with their leadership groups to do that, right? I mean, the owners are also being willing to open up their books and give away a percentage of revenue. And the NFL was, you know, which I wrote about in the book, was totally unwilling to do that the year before. They were unwilling to consider it. They were unwilling to, you know, and 10 years later, they ended up doing it. So a very long-winded answer. I don't know if I even answered your question.
That's great. We talked about Larry Fleisch and the players were a force. You know, that's something that we don't necessarily see today. The owners, David Stern and the owners, they were saying, hey, if we don't agree to this cap, this league may go under. How real of a possibility do you think that was? Because that's what they were claiming.
So that's what they were claiming. Look, I don't think there was any universe in which the entire NBA was going to go under. I don't think anybody really believed that.
They thought they may lose some teams. They like it. They we might be down to 8 to 10 teams.
I don't even think it would be that few. Yeah. I think it would probably be 5 or 6. The issue, right, was severalfold. Right, one was that you had these ownership groups, you know, like the Cleveland Cavaliers were legitimately very leveraged, and I've seen their internal data and it shows that they were spending like 3 times the money that they were bringing in on advertising alone, right? Mm-hmm. I think it was 2 or 3 times. There was certainly a circumstance, and the problem is that they couldn't sell these teams. Mm-hmm. I can't speak to how real these concerns were internally on the NBA side. I think they were real. I think that they were having a real hard time finding people who were willing to buy into these franchises. Because it was so unclear as to what the economic circumstances would be, not for the Lakers, not for the Knicks, but for a team like Cleveland or Utah or Indiana. And so I think that the logic was that, okay, well, we want to make, and the other problem is that none of these teams were, part of the benefit to the league was that they would now revenue share, and therefore these teams would be accountable to one another in a way that they weren't before. Yeah. They weren't sharing budgets. There, you know, I wrote about this in the book during these negotiations. At the beginning of negotiations, the NBA tried to go to the owners and say, hey, can we get a line of credit for all of us? And the bigger market teams were like, no, we're not going to do that. I'm not putting my credit on the line for Donald Sterling. I'm not putting my credit on the line for the Cleveland Cavaliers, and we're not going to do it. And so part of this deal was that it bound owners to one another. And I think the belief was that would make the league less unstable. And yes, I think it did. I think in that way it did. Right. But I do think it's a circumstance where the players were doing something for the owners. That doesn't mean there wasn't value in it for the players in some way, but it did do that.
A percentage of something is better than 100% of nothing. And as you mentioned, the league was kind of like the Wild Wild West before this cap. The owners were not unified. The Knicks and big market teams, they would make all the money. They wouldn't care about smaller market teams. And when you're a part of an organization, I always say, if you're Batman, like, we need the Joker. We need the Riddler. So it was in the best interest of those teams to help stabilize some of the smaller markets. And that's what this agreement did. And as you mentioned, it stabilized the league. I want to ask about Larry Fleischer's opponent, if you will, and David Stern. These are two tough lawyers. What can you say about the negotiation between them two, the back and forward?
Sure. So, you know, this Stern, right?
He wasn't the commissioner at that time.
No, this is the prequel, right? Yeah. This is as he's rising, right? And this is the first time he did this, right? And it was kind of funny, like, you know, I went back and I talked to people, whatever, the book, and everyone just assumed he had negotiated all these previous agreements. He didn't. This is the first time he's the chief negotiator. He had been involved, he had been, you know, but this is the first time he's at the table. And Fleischer's been doing this for 25 years, right? So Fleischer is not, you know, this is the only time where Stern was dealing with someone who had more experience on the other side than he did. And so what I think is fun, and part of the fun of the book was I was able to find all of these kind of internal documents that were basically transcripts of their meetings. And I do this for a living, and I knew that these existed because that's what you do when you're in collective bargaining. You have to take notes because someone's got to be writing a transcript, because in 3 years, if you're in an arbitration, you want to be able to say, hey, this is what we intended. And especially when you're creating a system as complicated as this one, you need to do that, right? You need to have. And so you basically have a transcript of what's going on back and forth. And look, the transcripts that I have came from the owners, not from the players. So you kind of got to take that with a grain of salt, right? But you also want to write down as honestly as possible as what's going on. And so, you know, what's fun is that, and you know, well, if you read the book, right? Like, they're going at it, yeah. Right? This is not a circumstance in which these are friendly negotiations. You know, they're yelling at each other. They're cursing at each other. You know, like, you know, and they're both advocating for reasonable positions at the table. And it seems like, you know, I think that when you think of a circumstance like this, you think it's going to be some kind of chummy relationship, or they're coming to the table and nope. This is an adversarial relationship. It is, right? And you can see that, like, it isn't disrespectful. At least this was my reading of it, right? They respected one another. They had an understanding for one another, but it's certainly adversarial. And when what, you know, there's one point where, you know, early on, you know, Stern is saying, you know, well, we're going to continue to operate in spite of ourselves. The Fleischer's like, get out of here with that, right? Like, you know, you want to shut down, go ahead. We don't care. We're not going to, you know, we're not going to do this to subsidize Donald Sterling, right? Which is right, right? And you know, Stern's like, well, do you have anything that you can do to help the league? And Fleischer's like, get better owners who have more money who market better, right? It's like, this is your problem. This isn't my problem. On the other side, right, at a certain point, you know, there's one time they're in negotiations and Fleischer is trying to kind of, like, he kind of agreed to something. He kind of wants to back out. He kind of wants to say, like, let's do this in 4 years. And Stern hammers him on it. Stern is like, you know, how dare you come in here? And he's right to do that too, right? Like, they're, you know, at one point, you know, at the very end, there's a strike date looming. They're far apart. Fleischer comes in with a comprehensive deal, right? He says, this is what we should do. And Stern's like, you got some nerve coming in here 2 weeks before a strike date with some complicated agreement when it took you 6 months to come back with something else, right? So these are two guys who respect each other, but they're professionals who are giving it to each other, right? And it's really high level, in my mind, right? It's high level negotiations. It's two smart, savvy guys with the buy-in of their constituents really hammering something out, which, that's what I thought of the back and forth. What did you think?
No, big time. Big time. Two skilled negotiators going back and forward. And speaking of Stern, a few years ago, he passed away. And, you know, I know he was revered by many. I didn't really know his story. To me, David Stern was the guy who would mess with Allen Iverson's dress code. So I didn't really know what to think of David Stern. But through this book, I said, oh, I get it now. I see why he is revered the way he is, when he walked into the NBA, they only had a handful of employees. You know, for me, after reading this book, I think his legacy should be how he marketed the league. He understood the league had a problem with this perception. Corporate America thought they was a bunch of drug-addled colored players. You know what I'm saying? He attacked that. We need to change that. So for you, I would ask, what about David Stern's contribution is maybe most impressive? What is his legacy to you?
It's a good question. I think the one thing that I came away with, and, you know, I've always liked Stern. Stern is not perfect. I'm not defending everything Stern did, right, especially later on. I'm not. I just kind of always felt like I felt like unlike maybe some other sports or other circumstances, I felt like he liked the league and I felt like he liked the sport.
Yeah.
And I felt like he enjoyed it.
He was defending the game. Yep.
I don't know. And I think that goes a long way. You know, I didn't think he kind of had a childlike reverence for it. Like I kind of talk about Bowie Kuhn a bit. He was the commissioner of baseball a long time ago. He kind of had this like childlike view of it. I felt like Stern loved the game. He loved the sport. He loved the players. But he was the owner's guy, right? So as much as those two things could be in conflict, I felt like he did it as best he could. You know, the one thing that I would say, which I found to be very impressive, was that Stern had tremendous vision. I mean, honestly, I felt like even, you know, I spent a bunch of time in the book talking about the TV deals and some of that stuff, and I had some of their internal documents. I mean, he saw a lot of the stuff before it happened. He saw international marketing. He saw, and he was incredibly meticulous. Like, he would have, they'd come back from the All-Star game, and he would have a memo of, like, where the Miller High Life booth was and why that was good or bad. Right. And so he really was, you know, he saw a bunch of aspects of the game that, you know, I don't know that somebody would have seen at a time when they have 5 employees or 6 employees. Yeah. I think that, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is that these institutions are not, they're made up of people who work there. They're made up of history of what goes into it.
Yeah.
And they're not, it has to develop over time, and it's a reflection of the people who work there. And so, you know, I think the part of this deal that they reached, right, that we're talking about, this is somewhat different, but part of what I tried to convey is that wouldn't have happened in baseball in 1982 because the players and the owners did not trust each other. Mm-hmm. I blame the owners. I blame the owners entirely at that time. And mm-hmm. Because the owners were unwilling to treat the players well, or as people, or respectfully. And the NBA owners were not perfect. I go through all kinds of ridiculous things that they did, but there was a degree of cooperation that existed from a labor relations standpoint. I mean, even I wrote about, you know, when the NBA was in trouble in 81, you know, they reached out to Larry Fleischer as like, hey, can you help us come up with ideas?
Yeah.
That would never have happened in baseball, ever. And it wouldn't happen. I don't think that would happen in baseball now,
right?
And I think that those cultures exist because of the people who are there. And that doesn't mean that these things aren't adversarial. And, you know, there's a lot of bad blood that existed in the NBA and continues to. But I think that those cultures, you know, like I talked about it, like in 1980, you know, and I know I'm kind of bouncing around a bit, but the cultures that exist come from the people who run it. And I think that Stern was a part of that. Like I talked about in 1980, you know, the NBA could have pushed a strike. They could have, you know, they were almost there, right? I wrote about that in the book. Adam Silver's father comes in the All-Star game and says, we shouldn't do this. We shouldn't push a strike to do X or Y. Let's get a deal. Let's keep things moving. Right. I don't think that would have happened in baseball. I don't think that happens if a different ownership group has I just think that these things develop by virtue of the people who were there at the times that they're there. And I think that, that spirit of cooperation is not absolute. But I think that that existed, and I think that part of that is because of Stern. And I think that part of that is because of Fleischer, too. So,
how did it come to be that Oscar Robertson, the Big O, is kind of credited with the advent of free agency?
Well, so, and I wrote about this a bit, right? The first part of the book is I talk about in 1967, right? Oscar Robertson is the president of the Players Union. No one cared about the PA. No one was paying attention. No one looks at what they do. No one did. Yeah. No one cared, right? If you want to find an article, you know, there were two articles about what I talked about. Larry Fleischer and Oscar Robertson get up during the All-Star break in 1967. And Oscar Robertson says, we want to do six things, right? We want to, and I apologize, I don't remember them off the top of my head. It's like page 8 of the book. But he literally lays out, like, hey, we want a review of the reserve clause, which is the aspect that kept players, you know, basically, you know,
bound to a team
in the control of the team. Yeah, for throughout their career, right? We want to make sure that we have a right to our likeness. We want to make sure that we have some version of that. We want a percentage of television revenues. We want to make sure that there's a cooperative among players in all sports. There were some other ones I forgot. It was incredibly visionary, right? And it's all things that we take for granted now. And he really laid out a roadmap, right? And part of that was that they wanted, you know, from, you know, 1960 really to 1970, the players are saying, hey, you know, hey, owners, work with us, right? You know, just kind of blow them off, right? Mm-hmm. Then we have the 1964 All-Star Game strike. The players say, hey, we're not gonna play this game. You're not gonna have your televised All-Star strike unless you listen to us. You want to say, okay, we're gonna work with you. And they kind of work with them, but they kind of blow them off again, right? Mm-hmm. And in 1967, I talk about it, right? Oscar gets up and he says, we want to do these six things. The owners ignore them. Players say, we're going to go on strike unless you reach a deal with us. And they reach the first collective bargaining agreement in the NBA history, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really move things forward that much, right? In 1970, right, the players sue the league, right?
Yeah.
And they are led by their president, Oscar Robertson, right? And Oscar Robertson has seen all of this develop over time, right? From he was a player before, he was at the 64 strike. He held out because he wanted to make more money, which it was entirely his right to do. He couldn't go anywhere else. He had a combative relationship with his team. And so in 1970, when the NBA and the ABA are merging, the players in the middle of the Eastern Conference finals get up and they say, we're going to sue the league.
Yeah.
And Fleischer got Oscar as the president and every single player rep. And he wanted every player rep to be the star of that team. And they all signed on. And then every single player signed on except one, which we can talk about. That's for entirely different reasons. because there was like a gambling issue where he said he wouldn't sue the league in. But every single player signs on. And they say, NBA, you are an unlawful monopoly. They are, right? And we're going to sue you, and what you have is unlawful, right? They wanted to stop the merger between the ABA and the NBA because the first time there was competition for salaries were shooting up. And they threw a couple things in. They said the reserve clause is unlawful. They say the draft is unlawful, which they are, right? You know, you have a job. You can go work anywhere you want. If you want to go, if you don't like working in New Orleans, you can go to LA.
Right.
You don't have to go somewhere because some team was bad.
Right.
Like, that's not how this stuff works, right? And so the NBA fought the players for 6 years. 6 years they are fighting, right? NBA is ignoring them. They're not dealing with it. And they couldn't merge. And we can go through all that stuff. That might be too you know, complicated, but we can talk about it if you want. But Oscar Robertson is the head of the union. He's leading the vision of suing the league. He testified in the Senate, and you should watch it. The video is up on YouTube. It's fantastic. Oscar is amazing. Talking about how, you know, if he wanted to go play somewhere else, they could blackball him. If he didn't want to do something, they could blackball him. They could, right? You know, in 1975, the players are going to go to trial, right? Mm-hmm. They have an early decision where the court basically says, hey guys, I don't see how any of this is lawful. I don't see how you're allowed to do any of this. I don't see how you're allowed to have a draft, how you're allowed to be a cartel and restrict the ability of talent. I don't see how you're allowed to say you can sign someone in perpetuity at rates that you determine.
Yeah.
I just don't see how any of this is going to survive antitrust scrutiny.
Right.
And so before they're about to go to trial, you know, the NFL was going through a similar case. MLB wins free agency because they said that this doesn't work. The NFL basically does the same thing. And the NBA, you know, the lawyers for the NBA at the time, David Stern's mentor, sends a memo to the commissioner basically saying, we got to make a deal here. Yeah. And they did. And so it's called the Oscar Robertson case. They reach a deal that basically is a 10-year phase-in of rights leading towards free agency. And that's basically what happened. So Oscar Robertson, you know, look, it's the Oscar Robertson case. There are a lot of people. There's, you know, it's not just, but Oscar had tremendous leadership, tremendous courage. I don't think it can ever be understated how much courage it took to do all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, these are people at work who are saying to their boss that we think you are an unlawful monopoly.
Absolutely.
And I'm a basketball player who might get blackballed, who might get thrown at, you might get, you know, whatever it was. So it was a very courageous thing that these players did. They were right, and it worked.
First off, it's comical. Josh, at times I would laugh out loud because I couldn't believe we were talking about the same league that's going on today. Like, every offseason you see all the fodder going on about free agency and the attention that's paid to that. The owners didn't even want free agency, all right? But one of the things that stood out to me throughout this book is the toughness, is the fearlessness, is the willingness to sacrifice and be selfless by some of the best basketball players in the world, their level of consciousness. In the book, the players at the 1964 All-Star Game, they were getting ready to strike. They were in the locker room prepared to strike if they didn't get what they wanted from the owners. You mentioned that when the ABA and the NBA were about to merge, the players said, hold on, if there's only one league, it's a monopoly. They could limit our salaries. We need to do something about that. Players fighting for free agency, players fighting for health benefits and retirement funds. They're in the prime of their life, living a good life. They didn't have to do that. Tommy Heisman, who was a member of the Boston Celtics, he had a great relationship with his owner, but he was willing to jeopardize that for the greater good of the players. Joshua, as a labor lawyer, as an NBA fan of today, when you hear these stories, like, how impressed are you? I was floored.
Me too, right? I mean, like, you know, look, all of this, I love the NBA. I think this stuff is fascinating. I just have tremendous reverence for them,
yeah.
Right? I mean, like, you know, the Tommy Heinsohn stuff where, you know, Tommy Heinsohn put a lot on the line for something that probably he didn't, you know, it probably wouldn't really benefit him.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and the truth of the matter is that, you know, look, like, and I wrote about it a bit in the book, and there are many villainous owners. I'm not saying owners are good. None of that. But, and not all owners are bad either. But the owner of the Celtics at the time seemed like a decent man. Seemed like he wasn't a villain, right? He drafted the first African-American in the history of the NBA. He was not like, you know, the owner of the Pistons at the time was villainous, but Walter Brown wasn't, and Heinsohn had a good relationship with him. It wasn't about you and me being friends.
Right.
It was about, hey, this isn't right. Right. It wasn't about like, and I think that that's something that, like, I think it's easy later to say, well, everything they did was right and everything worked out and whatever, you know, I kept putting myself in these guys' positions at that time. Right. You know, Fleischer, who I relate to as a lawyer and someone who would be in that position, you know, you're trying to advise these guys where there's no roadmap and say, yeah, we're just not going to play the All-Star game. Right. Like, you know, like, the idea of these things is so, and what was funny is even last summer when they were in the bubble and all these things were happening, people were like, oh my God, this is totally unprecedented. I was like, I kind of wish my book had already come out, but it wasn't unprecedented. There is a long legacy and a long line of activism, of selflessness, of consciousness of NBA players that I think is forgotten.
Yeah.
And that, you know, how impressive are these guys?
Big,
you know,
time.
I mean, all of them, I mean, even, you know, and not all of it's perfect,
no.
Right? Not all of it is ever, you know, but there was a very clear view of looking out for one another, looking out for each other. And I think that that's really important. It's incredibly impressive. And all these guys, Heinsohn, Oscar, and Silas. And
honorable, Lanier. Principled men. But that's not everybody, right? I have a quote here that was in the book from Dr. J. Julius Erving. And to me, this is what seems like is the sentiments of many of today's athletes. Dr. J, this is what he said leading up to the those negotiations that went between David Stern and Larry Fleisch and the players. Dr. J said, and I quote, "I would not sit around and sacrifice my present livelihood and lifestyle for the NBA and the players who will be in the league in 86 and 87. Basically, I'm not going to sacrifice my way of life for future players." And Joshua, when I look at the current state of professional athletes, not just in the NBA, but Major League Baseball and the NFL, and I see they're so disgruntled and they're unhappy about things that are happening with ownership and they believe they're getting a raw deal. Well, if you look in your history, you will see the blueprint or the steps that it's necessary to get what you want. And you got to be willing to sacrifice, Joshua. As a labor lawyer, when you see the current athlete who complains but may not be willing to pay the price and go to battle for what they want, what do you think? How fair is my assessment?
I respectfully disagree.
Okay.
I actually think that we have a pretty awesome generation of conscious athletes who are willing. I mean, if you look at who's been in the leadership of the NBPA over the last 10 years, mm-hmm. right? You've had Chris Paul, LeBron James, Steph Curry, CJ McCollum, you know, and then you have young guys coming up like Jaylen Brown and Malcolm Brogdon, like, and then, you know, and they've had, you know, different, you know, they've had journeyman guys like Anthony Tolliver. So it's not like, I don't think I agree. I think that they have been outspoken and willing to work together and been involved in their union. So, and like even in baseball too. I mean, last year when they were having their issues with ownership, I mean, you had Max Scherzer and was it Verlander? I forgot who were stepping up and saying, you know, Max Scherzer's got a $200 million contract. You know, he doesn't need, you know, but he's a trustee of the union, getting involved and being engaged. So I think that we actually are at a point where we actually have pretty good engagement and involvement. You know, and like Richard Sherman had a heavy involvement in the NFLPA. Like my view is that there is pretty good leadership and pretty good engagement. And that would be my view. But
Joshua, the negotiation we're referring to in the NBA with the cap, that's 1982, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That helped stabilize the league. That's when the NBA started to form into what we know as the league today. That fair? I would say today's athlete is a beneficiary of all that work, not a benefactor. What advances have they made since that negotiation? I was looking earlier today, 2005, the NBA players had 57% of basketball-related income. Today, they're down to 50%, Joshua, from 57 to 50. I don't think they're making any strides. And in fact, I think they're getting squeezed more and more with each negotiation. And I say it's because it's their unwillingness to pay a price. You know, going back to the book, these players were willing to strike at the All-Star game. Strike when the playoffs begin, when it would hurt the owners' pockets worse. A few years ago, Donald Sterling, they thought he was a racist. They were still prepared to play that day. So what advances have been made to move it forward the way Big O and Tommy Heisman have done?
Well, look, I understand what you're saying. And yeah, it's true. There was a higher percentage of revenue than they get now. And I'm not, you know, I don't know what happens in every single negotiations. Mm-hmm. I know that there was a lockout in 1999 and a lockout in 2011. I know that in 1995, they decertified the union and they had some tumult, and they, that was when they ended up with a rookie wage scale and I believe a max salary. So it is a different universe now than it was then. You know, the other thing that ends up happening, and this is just kind of, and here's the thing. I've negotiated enough agreements to know that if I'm not there, I'm not in a position to be critical of what someone else agrees to.
Yes, sir.
I don't know what's on the table. I don't know what those members want. I do also know that the pie has grown in the NBA. So, you know, I'm not going to defend, you know, I am somewhat agnostic. I'm not going to take a position one way or the other, because I don't know. I wasn't in those negotiations. I can't speak to it. And I'm not going to, you know, the one thing that I would say is that I think that part of there's two pieces, right? One is that labor contracts and labor negotiations develop over time. At a certain point, they mature, right? At a certain point, okay, maybe this is a system we can live with and we have to tweak it, right? In 82, 83, Larry Fleischer thought that the cap was temporary, right? He didn't necessarily think that this would be forever. And in 88, when it came up again, he was like, well, you know, we don't want it. We're done. You wanted to get back on your feet. You're back on your feet. There's no need for this. And, you know, what the players did, which I wrote about in the book, was pretty audacious. They basically were like, all right, we're going to, you know, your protection under antitrust law comes by virtue of the union. We're just going to get rid of the whole union. And now you're a monopoly. Like, how? Like, that's amazing, yeah. Right? It's so creative and aggressive. And the players ended up getting the freest free agency that exists. It's the only, they were the only sport where the top players could go from one team to another in free agency for any amount that they wanted without any compensation attached, right? Baseball, even still, you have that. So, you know, in terms of where they've gone since then, it's hard. You know, there are other aspects to it. There are other tweaks to it. The pie has grown. You know, there have also been two lockouts. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, you know, I think that under Michelle Roberts, the players have built an organization that I think reflects their values. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Michelle Roberts, you know, not all benefits are necessarily tied to economics. I think there are other aspects of it that they've wanted. But I would agree that the system as it exists now is just not as player friendly as it was then. I don't think there's any other way to say it.
Fair enough. I get frustrated when I see some of these players and they refer to our league, as if they're partners. And you mentioned that you had access to a lot of the internal memos. And one of the quotes that stood out to me, Junior Bridgman had asked David Stern, like during these negotiations, so that mean we're partners, right? And David Stern, quote, definitely no. The players will not be our partners, right? So I'm like, clear as day, you're not partners. You may have 50% of basketball-related income, but you don't decide which players are here, which franchises are in which city. You don't get a piece of the pie when these things are sold. So I just find myself frustrated with the activism or the willingness to fight from the players. I think they're a bit docile and content. With books like this, there's a lot of information you want to put in. It just had to be left on the cutting room floor. What's something you really wanted to get in there, but unfortunately it didn't make the cut?
Well, so the problem was that I think the deal with the publisher was that it was supposed to be like 75,000 words. Right. And I think I came in around 110. So I came in way, 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 way too long. So I didn't, you know, the one thing that I wrote a large amount about was about the 1967 strike, where basically, you know, the players had issued a strike date that was, it was the first real strike date, first real league-wide walkout. And it was set to coincide with the playoffs. And basically, you know, I talked about it a bit, you know, players of the All-Star break come out and say, these are the things that we want. Mm-hmm. And we demand a response by X date. And the owners just ignored them. And so the players said, okay, fine. We're going on strike a week before the playoffs. You know, good luck.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had contracts, they had all these things. They probably were exposing themselves to liability. And like John Havlicek said so. John Havlicek, you know, the great player on the Celtics, said like, yeah, we don't care. We think that this is important and we're going to do it. Yeah. And they did. And it was the first time, you know, and there was all this stuff going back and forth. And the owners were like, you know, very offended and kind of like so upset that the players would do this, you know. And they did. And the owners caved and the players got a collective bargaining agreement. They didn't get everything that they wanted. You know, they had to file a lawsuit 3 years later, but it was kind of the first time that they did that. And it was kind of, I felt like it was one of the only time that I had kind of seen where, you know, normally it would be like, okay, we're at the end, you know, in baseball, like they'd be like, okay, we're at the end of a cycle, right? Our agreement is expiring. This is when a strike or a lockout happens. And it kind of was like the NBA players were like, no, we're just going to do this because we feel like it. At a certain point, because we need this to happen now and we're not willing to wait anymore. So I thought that was a lot of fun. But it wasn't really directly tied into the story. And so I kind of, you know, I kind of did a lot in terms of the building of the union. So I figured that was the outside that could go.
I'm sure there was a lot of great stories involved or around during this time. One of them you did write in the book, and we mentioned his name a few times, Donald Sterling. Donald Sterling was a thorn in the owner's side for a long time. Mm-hmm. He decided one day that, hey, my San Diego Clippers, I want to move them to L.A. without notifying the league, without running it through the commissioner's office. And they actually gave him the boot back in the 80s. Somehow he ended up sticking around. What can you say about that fiasco?
So, Donald Sterling was he was a yutz then. And, you know, I mean, he got himself in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. He was very, very cheap. He was a gigantic embarrassment to the league from the minute he got in. He did all kinds of stuff. They tried to throw him out like five different times. But basically, you know, he was in San Diego, and he wanted to just move the team to LA. He signed a lease to go and he didn't tell anybody. And, he shows up to the owner's meeting. And the only reason why he did it was because someone, you know, basically the city of LA was trying to get a second team.
Yeah.
And so they said, we'll pick up all the costs of the lawsuit. So he said, great, I'll sign a lease to move to LA. And so he did it. He didn't do anything to like move the team.
Yeah.
They didn't sell any season tickets. You know, they were just a total disaster. And so the owners were like, they moved to throw him out of the league. And so basically what the NBA did, which is I think similar to kind of the Jerry Brian Colangelo, Sam Hinkie trusteeship in Philly recently, was they basically had a lawyer kind of go in and kind of professionalize the Clippers, you know, quote unquote, and basically like, you know, try and, cause they weren't paying people. Mm-hmm. They were trying to not abide by agreements. They were stiffing the printer of the programs for the team. You know, they were just really an embarrassment for the league. Yeah. And so the owners had voted to throw Sterling out and they were public about it. I mean, and so basically, you know, I honestly don't know who exactly put this guy, Alan Rosenberg, into the Clippers to try and, you know, professionalize them. And, you know, they did an internal investigation, you know, which I've seen, it's just quite funny, given how incompetent the Clippers were. And, basically, you know, Alan Rosenberg was like, look, like if you have any hope of ever selling this team to anyone else, you know, because the problem was that these teams were not selling, no one was buying. Don King was threatening to buy the Cleveland Cavaliers. These were not desirable. They weren't going for $2 billion the way they are now. They were having to sell to real hucksters. This was not, they were not going, you know, so basically like the Rothenberg's argument to the NBA was, if you ever want to sell this team for anything, kind of stop attacking your ownership group and we'll try and do these things. And that's how Sterling didn't get thrown out in the early 80s.
So when he made that decision to, hey, I'm going to LA, the league was kind of stuck with it, huh?
No. What ended up happening was they backed off. So I didn't tell that story well. So basically like he signs a deal to move to LA and basically the owners say, look, we're going to throw you out of the league. They also filed a lawsuit. And the problem was that Sterling owed all kinds of money all over the league. So he owed money here and there. And so basically the NBA said, fine, we're keeping your national television revenue and we're just going to keep it. And the court said, okay. And Sterling basically was like, well, I kind of would like that money, guys. And so he basically backed off and said, we're not going to move the team to LA. He ended up moving the team to LA later.
Right, right.
But at this original juncture, he did not. They stayed in San Diego.
Joshua Mendelson, again, congratulations on this book. This is amazing, man.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate you reading it. I appreciate that you liked it and that, you know, you're telling people about it.
Josh, what are you doing now currently? You're a labor lawyer, you say? You working in sports?
Yeah. Yeah, somewhat. I work for an entertainment union that does a bunch of sports stuff as well. And then I'm also a law school professor, okay. So I do that too.
You fighting for the good guys or the bad guys?
Good guys.
The good guys. All right. What's next, man? You putting pen to paper again or?
Maybe someday. I don't know. The problem was that like part of what was fun about this is that, it didn't exist.
Yes.
And no one had done it. And so I kind of felt like I was able to do something and I was kind of, I don't know if something will interest me in the same way.
Right.
So I got to figure that out. Nothing now.
Real quick. I saw on your Twitter that you were on, I guess a panel that was speaking about some of the new legislation that's going on with the NCAA. I think it was a court case you guys were speaking on, the NCAA versus Alston.
Yeah.
What's going on with that? If you could let us know what's that about.
So, I mean, it's basically what's funny is it's argued by a guy named Jeff Kessler. Jeff Kessler was the partner of Jim Quinn, who was the partner of Larry Fleischer. So this kind of comes from, and it's an antitrust argument as to the legality of the NCAA. So there is kind of a direct lineage from the book into this case. But basically what they're saying is that for lack of a better word, the NCAA is an unlawful monopoly, mm-hmm. which it is. I mean, I don't know if the Supreme Court's going to find it, but it's the same argument. It's the same cartel exploitation of labor argument that had been successful in professional sports 40 years ago.
Is this something new? I feel like that's a conversation that's been going on for a while, but I've been seeing this pop up a lot lately.
It's become more of an issue that they're kind of arguing. I mean, the case itself that they're dealing with here is somewhat narrow. Mm-hmm. And it's really kind of a narrow issue than kind of, you know, the Oscar Robertson case or the Messersmith McNally case in baseball, but it's the same universe. It's the same, you know, type of argument and, you know, it's unclear where exactly it goes. You know, they're kind of, And I am not, you know, a super expert, so I don't want to represent that I am. Right. But it, you know, they're really kind of going after kind of educational expenses. It's not like free agency in the same way. It's a narrower issue. But you know, we'll see how it goes. But it's the same general argument.
We'll see how it goes. Again, his book, The Cap: How Larry Fleischer and David Stern Built the Modern NBA. Joshua Mendelson, thanks for joining me, sir.
Thank you so much. It was a ton of fun. Thanks, William.
That's WBH Radio. I'm your host, William Holly. Wow.